Please rise. Session, Judge Johnson, Blascon Albrooks, Judge Peterson.
Please be seated. Excuse me, please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has six cases on its schedule, two of which will be submitted with oral argument and four of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case on today's schedule is State versus Casey Bauer, the consolidated appeals in A180876 and A181246. And I believe that the order consolidating cases determined that Mr. Bauer's counsel will argue first. Does counsel agree with me on that? Yeah. All right. Ms. Nelson, you may approach and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Julie Nelson. I represent the appellant Casey Bauer in this consolidated appeal. The state has appealed the district court's downward dispositional sentencing departure, and Mr. Bauer appeals from his convictions. I'll begin with Bauer's argument that plain error occurred when the district court failed to define great bodily harm when instructing the jury on the dangerous weapon element of second-degree assault. But before I get into the meat of it, I would like to clarify the record. In its brief, the state claimed that the parties had engaged in extensive discussions about jury instructions and that Mr. Bauer had made objections below, and based on that said that I had misled this court when I said that Mr. Bauer had not made any objections. My statement that there were no objections was in reference specifically to this issue, to the jury instructions on second-degree assault. And that fact is important because when there are no objections, then plain error analysis is a proper standard of review. The objections to which the state was referring in the discussions occurred on the last paragraph of the last page of the jury instructions. It involves superfluous language about reminding the jury that they're not partisans and advocates and that this case is important to both parties in language of the like. The objections had absolutely no relevance to this case or to this issue.
So the bottom line is you're saying the plain error standard of review applies here.
That is correct. And my concern was, well, one, my reputation with this court is I don't think I've ever been accused of misleading this court. And secondly, as I reread their brief yesterday, I thought, well, you know, it looks like this could almost be like an invited error type issue. And so I just did not want the court to get sidetracked with that. So plain error is the appropriate standard. And of course, with plain error, what we're looking at is there error that was plain and did affect Bauer's substantial rights? You can find the plain error in this case based on this court's holding in State v. Moore. And I'm going to cite it because there are two more cases that I cite in my brief. The one I'm referring to is a 2015 case, 863 Northwest 2nd, 111. And in that case, this court looked at what the definition of force is in the context of third-degree criminal sexual conduct and whether it was plain error for the district court not to give the statutory definition of force. This court ultimately decided that it was not plain error, but not because the court didn't err, but because there had been nothing before that said that the court needed to do that. With that, Moore now says, this court's holding and Moore says that if detailed definitions of the offense elements are necessary, if omission of the definition could mislead the jury or cause the jury to speculate about what the state must prove to obtain a guilty verdict, it must be given. And that's exactly what happened here. Because whether the small bat in this case constituted a dangerous weapon was a fact for the jury to decide. But not giving them the definition of what great bodily harm is, they were not equipped with the right information to make that assessment.
I recall in Moore that Moore persuaded the court that the statutory definition was necessary because by demonstrating that the lay definitions were meaningfully different and by kind of putting those in front of us to say, a lay juror following the lay understanding of the word would think it to mean X, Y, and Z, and that's inconsistent with the statutory definition.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And
in this case, I mean, can we do the same thing? Can we say the same thing?
Absolutely, and here's why. The jury instructions actually involved three definitions. Well, as we know, there are three statutory definitions. We're talking about bodily harm. There's bodily harm, great bodily harm, and substantial bodily harm. And we got definitions for regular bodily harm and substantial, but not great. I would challenge anyone to ask anyone on the street what great bodily harm means and see what they come up with. I can guarantee they are not going to come up with the definition that it's bodily injury which creates a high probability of death or which causes serious permanent disfigurement or which causes a permanent protracted loss or impairment of the functions of any bodily member or organ or other serious harm. No one's going to come up with that. And the problem specifically
What would they come up with?
Well, they would have to do what the jury came with, what actually the court had instructed them to do, which was apply the common and ordinary meaning. I don't know what the common and ordinary meaning is, but what they had would be, well, we know what bodily harm is, and we know what substantial bodily harm. Where does great bodily harm fall in it? Is it more than substantial, or is it less than substantial? They didn't even decide. There's no definition of great versus substantial. So I don't think we know what they would come up with. And the problem with that is, because the jury found that found Bauer guilty of second and third degree assault, which requires a finding of substantial bodily harm, they could very easily have just said, well, substantial and great are the same thing. They're pretty close in meaning, aren't they? Therefore, as long as the bat could cause substantial bodily harm, which it did, they could find that the bat was a dangerous weapon. And that's where the error is. This is a decision that the jury had the right to make. It was in their purview to make it. Mr. Bauer had a right to have the jury instructed on all the elements of the offense. And because he didn't, this was plain error that affected his substantial rights.
Okay, Moore went on to address the substantial rights. Why in this case, and it specifically said in the context of jury instructions, an error affects substantial rights when there is a reasonable likelihood that a more accurate instruction would have changed the outcome in this case. Where is the reasonable likelihood? Why is it reasonably likely that a more accurate instruction would have changed the outcome in this case?
Because I think a couple of reasons. First of all, given the definition of great bodily harm, I think it's very likely that the jury could have said, well, this bat wasn't capable of causing great bodily harm. And they could have used the fact that it didn't cause great bodily harm. They could have decided that, and that's not what the state is required to prove, and I'm not suggesting that at all. It certainly is a factor. It is something that can inform the trier of fact that this did not cause great bodily harm. Therefore, it may not have been capable of doing that.
So now I understand that the bat actually was presented. And did the jury take the bat into the jury room? I was reading one of the instructions, and I inferred that from that instruction.
I would assume that they did. Certainly, guns with safety precautions on bats go in.
Was there conflicting testimony about how the bat was used in the attack?
I think there was some, in fact. I think it's assumed that the bat, I think that JF did testify that he was hit over the head with the bat. I don't know that he was hit in other places with the bat. It sounds as though that Bauer may have struck him physically as well.
And the injuries, were they limited to lacerations?
There were two lacerations to his head. I believe he also suffered some bruising to his torso and face. But again, whether those were caused by the bat or not, I think is unclear.
Okay. I have similar questions about the bat. I'm trying to get a sense. I mean, I think I read it's a small baseball bat, but I'm unclear whether that means 28 ounces versus 32, or is it one of those little souvenir bats, you know, like this that you give to a child, or what?
What I can tell you is, and I actually did look for actual dimensions of the bat in the trial testimony. I couldn't find the actual dimensions. I believe that the actual bat was Exhibit 1, and there's a picture of the bat as well. If you take a regular-sized bat, it was smaller than that, but it's not one of those little ones that I think, you know, souvenir bats that you're talking about. It is just simply smaller than average.
Is it a bat you could use to hit a baseball in a game?
I don't know.
Is it ornamental?
I don't know. It might be like more like a child's bat, you know, the kind of a bat that you might give to a child to play with, because a big bat might be too big for them.
Yeah, but they could swing at a baseball with it.
I would think so. But just to be clear, this is not, I want to make sure that the court understands, I'm not arguing sufficiency of the evidence at this point as to whether the bat was dangerous or not. Just arguing that was a determination for the jury to make whether or not the bat was dangerous.
But you do seem to be making the distinction between what the bat might have been capable of doing with respect to damage versus what happened, and asking us to really rely on what happened as opposed to what it was capable of?
To be clear, it's because the jury could take a look at that information to determine whether it believed the bat was dangerous or not. But that is not, I'm not arguing right now whether the bat was dangerous. I'm arguing that was a determination for the jury to make specifically.
And they couldn't make it without a definition of great bodily harm.
Not given that they were given definitions of bodily harm and substantial bodily harm in particular. Maybe if those definitions hadn't been given, they might have come up with something. But I might still be here arguing otherwise. But certainly that conflated what great bodily harm means. And the other thing that's really important here is that whether or not this bat was a dangerous weapon was highly contested at trial. And that means that that's a factor this court should consider in determining whether or not it affected substantial rights. In cases where this court and the Supreme Court have found that the omission of the instruction of the element of the offense did not affect substantial rights. In those cases, those elements weren't argued. So, for example, State v. Edwards, Peterson v. State, State v. Moore, I talk about all of these in my brief. In those cases, the element was not argued. Therefore, the appellate courts have said, well, then it wouldn't have mattered. But here it was hotly contested whether or not that bat was dangerous.
I'd like to ask a question about the sentencing issue.
Yes.
While we still have some time. If we agree with you that the second degree conviction has to be reversed, why would the remedy be to remand for a new trial rather than to remand for sentencing on the third degree conviction?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
The defendant here was convicted of both second degree assault,
yes,
and third degree assault.
Correct.
And you're arguing that the second degree conviction should be reversed. If we agree with you about that, you also argue that the remedy would be to remand for a new trial. Why wouldn't an appropriate remedy be to remand for sentencing on the third-degree conviction rather than for a new trial?
Well, I would certainly prefer the latter. But I believe that if we are going to remand because of an improper jury instruction, if that's what you're getting at, remand for the second-degree assault, then the proper remedy is to remand for a new trial so that the jury could be properly instructed the next time around and determine whether or not you would still be convicted of second-degree assault.
Well, what would be the situation with respect to potential third degree as a lesser included offense in that trial? He's already been tried and convicted on that. Could that even be an issue in that trial?
No, it wouldn't be. He's already been convicted of that. But it would just be for the second degree assault. And if the state chose not to go back to trial on it, then the third degree conviction would remain, and he would be sentenced on that.
So is it a matter of choice for the state?
At that point, yes.
Well,
But either way, if they go back and I guess the way I would look at it is either way, the third degree conviction has to be vacated because it's a lesser included of the second degree. But once you go back on remand, it's up to the state to decide what it wants to do. If it wants to retry Mr. Bauer on the second degree assault and he's found guilty, the third degree he's found guilty from the first trial, but it's not a conviction because it's a lesser included. But if the state were to decide not to retry him, then the third degree assault conviction could come back because he'd already been found guilty on that. And that would not be retried. I'm not challenging the conviction on third degree.
So you're saying that a possible outcome of this would be it would be remanded. The state would choose to say, rather than charge him again with second degree, we'll just ask that sentence be imposed for the third degree conviction that they've already obtained.
It could certainly do that, yes. Yes.
But if that were the option, I mean, it would seem to me we would not vacate the conviction here. We would leave that decision to the district court.
But it would have to be vacated if the second-degree assault then became a conviction, only because it's a lesser included.
I understand that.
Yeah,
but if we vacate a conviction, it can then be reinstated? Is that?
I would think so. Well, if you're going to, well, no, I take that back. Actually, Your Honor, I take that back. If you were to vacate the second degree assault charge based on the erroneous jury instruction, then the third degree assault conviction would not need to be vacated because it's a lesser included of nothing at that point.
Right. It's just a separate.
Correct.
Your argument is that he can't be convicted of both. If
Correct.
We reversed one,
right.
He couldn't be convicted of both.
Yes, I should have thought that through a little more carefully. Apologize. Very briefly, with my minute and a half remaining, I would like to address a sentencing issue. As this court's well aware, this is abuse of discretion. This court, the state Supreme Court, gives great, great deference to the decision of the district court in making sentencing departures. Even if this panel, if any judge on this panel, any other judge would have handled this case and the sentencing case differently, that is not reason to reverse. The district court did come up with reasons, came up with very good reasons, in fact. One in particular is that he made the decision that Bauer spending 15 months in teen challenge to turn his life around is a significant reason, and that is supported by State v. Nelson, State v. Hennessy, State v. Dockin, and State v. Malinsky. Those are all cases that say that's a substantial reason to do it. He did find that teen challenge would be helpful to Bauer because of his chemical dependency, and that it's better for Bauer and society for him to go to teen challenge than go to prison. And again, that decision to do that is supported by case law as well, State v. Haywood and State v. Malinsky. The other part of this, if I can just have, I'm going to go over. Can I have 10 seconds?
Go ahead.
Yep. Thank you. Had he been convicted, he likely would have served less than a year in jail. Trog and McAllister both say that avoiding short-term commitment will support departure where commitment would have less value for the defendant and society.
Has he begun teen challenge?
He has. He's just about done with it. He's doing very well. He should be out this month. Mm. Really enjoying it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the state, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and then begin.
Terrence Swihart, Assistant Rice County Attorney, on behalf of Appellant State of Minnesota. Prior to my oral argument, Your Honors, I'd like to apologize to Ms. Nelson. And looking at my brief, I did indicate it was a bit misleading as my comment. It was never intended to impugn Ms. Nelson's character. I've had briefs before against her, and she is a stellar attorney, and I apologize to the court and Ms. Nelson for that statement. The other thing I'd like to concede is that Ms. Nelson's argument of the third-degree assault as a lesser included and should not in conviction should not have been entered by the district court. That is correct, and I concede that point as well.
So then what would be the situation if we were to conclude that the second degree has to be reversed?
Well, I think if then the lesser included offense would take effect and the district court would then sentence on the third degree assault. With respect to
your concession only applies in if we affirm the second degree.
Right.
Okay.
With respect to the issue presented by the state, Your Honors, it is our contention that the district court abused its discretion when it granted Mr. Bauer's request for a dispositional downward departure. It abused its discretion. The district court abuses its discretion when its reasons for downward dispositional departure are improper, insufficient, and there's insufficient evidence within the record to support that dispositional downward departure. To avoid that abuse of discretion, the district court must determine must exercise the discretion by deliberately considering the circumstances for and against a downward dispositional departure. In this case, the request was made by the defense attorney for a downward dispositional departure. The district court relied on two bases for which to downward depart, and that was that Mr. Bauer was particularly amenable to probation. And then that, based on the teen challenge, that in itself was a substantial, significant and substantial circumstance by which to downward depart. The district court's decision to downward depart based on amenability to probation is a basis by itself to downward depart. However, in order to do that, the district court must or should consider a non-exclusive list of factors, which you're aware of are the Trog factors. In this case, the court minimally addressed any of those factors. And if you review those factors, it's our opinion that obviously those factors don't support the downward dispositional departure. Specifically, criminal history is for one. In this case, Mr. Bauer had a significant criminal history, and although some of that criminal history involves traffic offenses, the district court is not precluded from considering those traffic offenses as a basis on criminal history. And the criminal history by itself can suggest that a defendant is not particularly amenable to probation. And in this case, Mr. Bauer had a gross misdemeanor in 2013. He had six, as my brief indicates, he had six misdemeanors, one of which he was on probation at the time he was sentenced for domestic assault, a fairly significant offense. And at the time that the PSI was conducted, Mr. Bauer was in violation of his probation in Dakota County for that domestic assault that occurred in 2017. In addition to those criminal offenses, Mr. Bauer also had roughly 12 traffic offenses, which indicates that this criminal history by itself, I would argue, indicates that there is no amenability to probation. Mr. Bauer, at the time of the sentencing, was 27, which again, taken into his age, which is another factor, another trog factor. At the time the offense occurred, he was 25. By the time sentencing occurred, he was 27. Yet in that time, he accrued roughly, again, seven criminal cases and 12 traffic violations. So the age by itself, age does not weigh in favor of a downward dispositional departure because of the significant criminal history associated with such a young individual. Related to the criminal history is the Mr. Bauer's compliance with probation. And the history in this case indicates that Mr. Bauer was in violation of his probation in Dakota County because he had not completed his domestic abuse counseling or the domestic abuse treatment program that was part of his probation. And as a result, as the PSI indicates, the Dakota County had filed a probation violation because of his noncompliance with probation. And amenability to probation depends on the defendant's ability to comply with the conditions of probation. And here there was already evidence in the PSI that there was no compliance or that there is prior noncompliance on a probation in a probationary setting. In addition to that, and while the probation officer's recommendation is not determinative, it is entitled to consideration. And in here, the probation officer, based on the facts and the circumstances which he considered or obtained, recommended to the court that probation not be granted because of what information that probation officer found. With respect to then the, and going back then to the, I'm sorry, taking a step back to the criminal history, the district court did address criminal history. And the argument from defense counsel there was criminal history only matters if there's a felony. There's no case law that indicates that only felony, prior criminal history related to felonies is the consideration and an analysis for a downward dispositional departure. And in fact, just the opposite is true with the case law indicating that even traffic offenses can be considered in prior criminal history. So the argument that a felony is only thing that you consider is wrong. And the district court relied on that argument and said, since you don't have any felonies, I'm disregarding your criminal history or it's not significant or substantial enough. I think that was an abuse of discretion by the district court and an erroneous application of the case law. Then going to probation, compliance, I'm sorry, another factor is the ability of Mr. Bauer to cooperate with probation. And violating conditions of release is a factor that the district court should consider when determining whether to downward depart, dispositionally downward depart. In this case, Mr. Bauer was granted a 72-hour furlough, and while on that furlough, did not return and essentially remained.
But his mother did die during that time, didn't she?
Yes, she died, yes.
And her funeral was scheduled for a period or for a date outside that period.
Right.
These are rather unusual circumstances.
They're unusual circumstances, but nevertheless still a failure to cooperate with the furlough. And the district court addressed that and said, you know, what you should have done is contacted me. You should have written me a letter. And I think the district court says, I may not have granted it, but the appropriate resolution was to address this issue with me, not just simply abscond and not return.
Right, but it's clear that the district court didn't conclude that he was just blowing it off.
Yeah, right. He didn't say that. There was obviously a reason to do that, but there was also that was a consideration that should have been taken into effect. And if it demonstrates a failure to cooperate, although there are extenuating circumstances, does that negate his failure to cooperate on the 72-hour furlough? I would argue it does not because the district court, there were alternatives. He was represented by an attorney. That attorney certainly had the capabilities to petition the court to extend that furlough. None of that was done by Mr. Bauer. None of that was done to the district court. The district court addressed that. So although there are these extenuating circumstances with respect to his mother, there are also appropriate avenues by which to remain on that furlough, and which he didn't engage in. So I'd argue that the cooperation piece is not there, and the district court should have considered that as well when determining whether downward dispositional departure was appropriate.
Well, just to re-examine your phrasing, I mean, it seemed to me the district court did consider it. It just didn't reach the conclusion that you feel it should have.
Yes, I suppose that's a more appropriate argument, yeah. So he did address it, and the court didn't then, along Judge Peterson's line of reasoning, is that you didn't comply, but there's a reason for you not to comply.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next factor is the, what really comes down to is the Minnesota Dean Challenge and how the district court addressed that with relationship to Mr. Bauer. And I think it's significant that Mr. Bauer hadn't completed the Rule 25, although within the PSI it talks about that he got his own chemical dependency assessment. There's no Rule 25. Mr. Bauer was not accepted into the program yet even. The judge, in general terms, and I think in the transcript clearly reflects this, the judge with everybody, and I think he said to the attorneys, you're both aware of my feelings on Teen Challenge, and I love Teen, he didn't say, I'm paraphrasing, I love Teen Challenge. Any chance I can get to send a defendant to Teen Challenge instead of prison, I'll do it. And so the court, based on its belief for Teen Challenge, then sent Mr. Bauer to Teen Challenge as a dispositional departure. And I think the other significant piece is that within the PSI and the arguments of counsel, there was no chemical dependency issue that percolated to the top, if you will. There's the Dakota County referenced in the PSI says he's had clean UAs since he's been on probation here. There's in the PSI it says, I believe it talks about Mr. Bauer indicates that there's no mental health issues that he's experiencing. And so chemical dependency was never an issue raised by Mr. Bauer, either PSI. It was only at the time of sentencing that was raised. And so the court then proceeds into an argument with itself about, well, that may be the case, but I talked to somebody in Rochester, and this person in Rochester tells me there's other things that Teen Challenge can do for you. And in fact, in the downward dispositional report, the court simply checks the box for particularly amenable in treatment, and then checks the box as other, but doesn't provide a basis on what that other is, other than to the record, which says it'll do you well instead of going to prison. But
it seemed like the district court, didn't the district court make some statement somewhere that it was going to help him to alter his way of thinking about things or approaching things? Or
yeah, I think the court did do that. But again, that's based on a generality of the district court's understanding of Minnesota Teen Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's important is the under individualized treatment for downward dispositional departure, the court needs to, it must be supported by the fact that the offender is particularly amenable to a relevant program and individualized treatment in a probationary setting. The court did not reference or specifically identify how Mr. Bauer was going to be particularly amenable to Minnesota Teen Challenge individualized treatment offered by Teen Challenge. It was really, I'm going to send you here because you're just going to be warehoused in prison. Mm-hmm. So there's no specificity on how Minnesota Teen Challenge was going to help Mr. Bauer in this setting. The Rule 25, had it been conducted, would have provided the court with alternatives of this treatment program would be best fit for Mr. Bauer, or the Rule 25 would have said inpatient treatment is appropriate or outpatient treatment, or he can get whatever services are offered within prison. But the Rule 25 wasn't conducted, so the district court had to go really off of its own personal knowledge of Minnesota Teen Challenge, which it did not apply specifically to Mr. Bauer, but was just, again, in a general sense of, I like Teen Challenge, I'm going to send you there. Those factors that the court's lack of finding how that would specifically help Mr. Bauer, again, does not support the downward dispositional departure. And again, the next factor that the court should have considered, which it didn't, is remorse, because remorse is relevant, especially in person crimes, which this was. And a notable lack of meaningful remorse is inconsistent with a finding of particularly amenable to probation, which in this case, Mr. Bauer didn't express absolutely no remorse. In the PSI, he claimed that he was a victim. At trial, he claimed he was a victim, which is fine, that's his defense. But then afterwards, after being convicted of the offense, there was, again, a complete lack of remorse, or at least no express remorse. In the district court, again, kind of dismissed this argument by saying, well, I kind of know what happened, but I'm not going to get into it. Again, Mr. Bauer's complete expression of remorse weighs against a dispositional departure. I think when this court reviews those factors relied on by the district court, it will come to the conclusion that the district court relied on improper and insufficient factors or factors when determining that a downward dispositional departure was appropriate. And then the court, if those factors aren't appropriate, can do that independent analysis to determine if there were any alternative bases by which to dispositionally downward depart. And I don't think there were any. I mean, the record is what I've gone through. There's nothing more that would support an alternative basis for downward dispositional departure. And the departure report also does not support that. With my remaining time, Your Honors, I'd like to just briefly address Mr. Bauer's issue. And I think the case of State v. Moore supports our position more than it does Mr. Bauer's position. Specifically, in State v. Moore, it did say that, you know, you should have provided the definition of force, because force is defined, and it cited numerous dictionaries, American Heritage Dictionary, and for example, force is defined as vigor, and it's completely different than the definition of force.
Well, how here could the jury have concluded that there was, that the bat could have caused great bodily harm without a definition of great bodily harm?
If I could answer your question by going over it, that's appropriate.
Yes, please do.
I think the jury instructions provide the basis, because if you look at the jury instructions, it's bodily harm is defined in the first jury instruction on element one. If that's defined, then you have substantial bodily harm defined in the third element. And then within the second element, it has great bodily harm, which is related to death. So you have death or great bodily harm. You have two definitions that are already defined. Within then that second element, you have great bodily harm related to death. So you have death.
Right, but there's a very specific statutory definition for great bodily harm. I can't imagine that anyone would give that. I mean, if you just ask someone on the street what the common meaning of great bodily harm to include requirements like permanent disfigurement or permanent or protracted loss of a function of any bodily member, I mean, who would do that?
I agree that you ask somebody on the street about what great bodily harm means by Minnesota statute, they would never espouse.
So why wouldn't they have to speculate about what actually had to be shown to determine whether this was a dangerous weapon?
I don't think they speculated. I think they relied on that jury instruction for death or great bodily harm. I think the jury was certainly capable of saying you have death or great bodily harm. I think the jury could have said great bodily harm is something less than death because you have that relationship between the two within
right,
the jury instruction.
But how much less than death would be the question, wouldn't it?
I suppose you're right.
I mean, substantial bodily harm is less than death, too.
Well, substantial bodily...
How would we know whether they, in determining whether in the manner in which the bat was used, it was likely to produce great bodily harm, what went through their heads? I mean, what standard they would have used to make that determination?
Yes, and I don't know what went through their heads, but my argument, Your Honor, is that substantial bodily harm is defined within the third element, with bodily harm defined in the first element, and the great bodily harm is obviously greater than that because you have its association with death, whereas substantial is not. So great bodily harm, by the jury instructions, in my reading, is that something better, something greater than substantial, because it's substantial doesn't refer, have any reference to death, whereas great bodily harm is that relationship between death or great bodily harm. And bodily harm, obviously, by that definition, is less than substantial. So by reading the jury instructions, the jury could conclude that bodily harm is less, substantial is greater, with great bodily harm being the greatest. If I could just make one more argument related to the Moore case, and assuming, if I may, I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Judge Peterson, if you determine that the jury instruction should have been defined as it was in Moore, ultimately then you make to determine whether that was the error was plain. And in Moore, the court said force should have been defined, but was that error plain? They said no, it wasn't plain, because nowhere was it required that force be defined within that.
But why hasn't Moore set the requirement that when a specific statutory term is defined, it needs to be, that definition needs to be included in the instruction?
I'm reading more, I guess, in a narrow interpretation specific to the jury instruction related to force, because force was defined.
So why would there be a different rule for force versus any other defined term?
Because I think in prior case law, for example, in Weyes, State v. Weyes, which I cite in my brief, you have numerous case laws that indicate that jury instruction 13.10 is an accurate definition, if you will, of dangerous weapon, and that I think in Weyes it says within that jury instruction, great bodily harm does not need to be defined within dangerous weapon. So you've got, assuming that it should have been defined, my reading of Moore is that because there was no case law, the absence of defining great bodily harm was not in direct conflict to case law or an established legal principle. And as a result, the failure to define great bodily harm was not plain error. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Swihart. Ms. Nelson, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Okay, just very briefly regarding the sentencing. The district court's not required to go through all the Trog factors to find any one in particular or all of them. The court never once said, I like Teen Challenge, I'm sending him there. Casey Bauer had made a statement in his PSI saying, I want to change my life. I think Teen Challenge is going to help. His attorney made that same argument during the sentencing hearing, and the judge found that Teen Challenge would be helpful to him, even and specifically regarding this whole furlough issue, where he said, boy, you need to think about how you do things. I think Teen Challenge will help you with that thought process. So it was never a matter of, I like Teen Challenge, I'm sending you there. It has no bearing whether or not Bauer had been accepted to Teen Challenge at the time of sentencing, because his acceptance at Teen Challenge was a condition of probation. Had he not gotten into Teen Challenge, the judge would have executed his sentence. The chemical dependency, again, this was not an issue that was relevant at trial. It never would have been allowed in trial, so there's no reason to bring it up, but clearly Casey Bauer had a chemical dependency issue, and that is something that Teen Challenge could address. This is really important, because this is not the rare case for an appellate court to reverse a district court's decision in sentencing, and I encourage this court to really take a careful look at Soto. Soto being a first-degree criminal sexual conduct case with absolutely horrible facts. Brutal attack. And even in that case, there was a split decision among the Supreme Court where the four justices agreed that it should be remanded, but three of the justices dissented on the very, very point of, we don't get involved in the district court's determination on sentencing. And that was a case, again, first degree criminal sexual conduct, and we're talking about a departure from 144 months mandatory commit down to probation. This is not that case. We're talking about the difference between 23 months, of which Mr. Bauer would have served less than a year, and probation, which he actually has done more time in Teen Challenge because of that programming. So this is not the case to reverse on that. And then I want to talk very briefly about the substantial rights, Mr. Bauer's substantial rights. This is one of the reasons I really believe that his substantial rights were affected with the jury instructions, is because based on not giving the jury the definition of great bodily harm, the jury could have found that the bat was capable of great bodily harm based on the definition of substantial bodily harm, which is the lower standard. And read the instructions all you want without the judge telling you what great bodily harm means or what order these go in, the jury was told to apply the common ordinary meaning. And even with that, a common ordinary meaning of great bodily harm, I would think the jury would look at that and say, well, substantial has a definition, but great bodily harm doesn't. I don't know what it means. And so they could have actually applied that lower standard to the bat to determine that it was a dangerous weapon. This is why this was plain error. This is why it affected his substantial rights. This is why this needs to be remanded.
Isn't it fair to assume that an ordinary person would believe that great bodily harm is more harmful than substantial bodily harm?
I don't think so. I really don't. Nothing surprises me anymore, but it's substantial or great. I don't know. I think great could be greater than substantial, or substantial. It's substantial. That's more than great. I think a juror could find either way. But even if they could find that, make the right decision or right assessment that grate is more than substantial. We still don't know what it means. We still don't know that it needs permanent disfigurement. And would they have found that in this case with this bat, as it did not appear that the permanent disfigurement occurred?
On the second requirement for the plein air test, did the Moore court, when determining that the error there was not plain, did the Moore court confine itself to that particular instruction, that statutory definition, or was it broader than that in the sense that, you know, just statutory definitions in general?
It found that no court had made the determination that force needed to be defined. However, it does, I believe, refer back to another Moore case, talking about how, but very general, kind of superfluous language again about how definitions should be given if it's going to be confusing to the jury. But I think that the broader context and the holding of this court in Moore is that statutory definitions, when there are statutory definitions of elements of an offense, they must be given to the jury if it could otherwise be confusing to the jury or cause the jury to speculate as to what the state has to prove. And that is exactly what happened here. So Mr. Bauer is requesting that his convictions be vacated and or that his sentence be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready. Second case on